But the native people are not satisfactory workers. We want American woodsmen who can use the axe and saw. Here is what the finished product looks like." He produced four small pieces of golden kauri wood.
"Ah," said Flens.
The wood glowed as though sunlight were sequestered in every atom.
"Best house-building wood in the world," said Blust.
Flens brought the samples back to Chicago, and the board passed the polished, blemish-free pieces from hand to hand. Kauri was a pine, and when they heard of the tree's generous manner of growth, enormous and straight for 100 feet, all the limbs clustered at the top, they voted to know more.
"It is reputed to be the most perfect tree on earth for the timberman," said Flens. "Or at least this fellow Blust claims it is."
No one on the board knew much about New Zealand. Lavinia wanted to meet Blust. She wanted to see the kauri forests before the company made a leap into the dark. It might be the Michigan forests all over again. And so the journey was arranged. She and Dieter Breitsprecher, recovered though somewhat scarred, would travel to Sydney on their honeymoon trip, meet with Blust, then continue to Auckland and for themselves see the kauri of the Coromandel Peninsula. Before they left, Lavinia spent separate hours with Lawyer Flens and Axel Cowes. "Mr. Flens," she said, "I think of you not only as my advisor and executor in all financial affairs, but as a friend. I have complete confidence in you. While Dieter and I are away, I will give you a power of attorney to handle business matters. If you have doubts or questions on any matter, please consult with Axel Cowes."
"Do not worry, dear Lavinia. All will be as you yourself might act."
He smiled his curling smile, a gold tooth sparking. He took her right hand in his.
"On my life," he said.
Both Lavinia and Dieter were prostrate with seasickness for the first weeks of the voyage. The captain, whose ship Duke and Breitsprecher owned, was at his wit's end in suggesting cures until the mate gathered remedies from the scuttlebutt. The one that worked came from the Chinese cook, ginger tea and walking the deck every other hour.
"Never go below decks," said the cook,
bringing the invalids a great steaming pot reeking of ginger. Lavinia took 3 sweetened cups and walked for half an hour, her eyes on the horizon. Dieter found a single cup efficacious, and by dinner time the 2 vomiters were well enough to eat boiled beef and turnips. The shared illness somehow united them as the marriage ceremony had not, and on board the bounding ship with a load of pine planks rubbing against each other in the hold, Dieter and Lavinia began a sexual adventure. Dieter was delightedly astonished at how responsive and inventive Lavinia became in the narrow berth. The crew could hear laughter and occasional whoops from their quarters. The cook claimed it was another of the salubrious effects of ginger tea. Harry Blust met their ship.
"Ah, a long voyage, what?"
He explained that Sydney was still an infant city, both swampy and dusty, both crowded and empty, both brash and genteel. "How interesting," said Lavinia, "but all I hope for at the moment is accommodations on immovable ground."
"Quite, quite, accommodations. You understand, guest houses and inns are few. During the gold rush, there were innumerable doss houses, quite unsuitable. We have arranged for you to stay at a government official's house. He is in London until the turn of the year. I think you will be comfortable for the weeks before you sail to New Zealand. I have arranged several small dinners with men in the timber business."
The arranged dinners were all alike. Vinous English businessmen hoping to strike deals to sell their lumber, most of which, Lavinia gathered, came from New Zealand, where choppers were bringing down the trees.
"Yes," said one bland fellow, touching his lips with his napkin. "Lumber ships crowd New Zealand harbors. Ships take on kauri, totara, and rimu. I say most abound here for New South Wales, which is expanding like the very devil."
"But we are here to see about the possibilities of logging ourselves," said Lavinia. The men looked at Dieter as if to ask him to silence his wife. A woman had no place discussing logging nor lumber.
They could not bring themselves to discuss anything with her, deferred instead to Dieter. Conversation languished. Lavinia and Dieter said good night as soon as they could without giving offense.
I hope it is better in New Zealand, said Lavinia. These fellows are small-time operators. They are only concerned to sell a load or two of their planks. They are supplying building material for New South Wales. That is their market. They do not understand serious logging.
She waved her arm in a circle that included the fruit bats.
It makes me question the abilities of Mr. Blust. I hope it is not the same in Auckland.
Let us first see the trees, said Dieter.
Before they had left Chicago, Dieter arranged, with advice from Mr. Marsh, the rental of a private house in Auckland for their month-long stay. Their contact would be a man named Nashley Oval, an English artist, who had a government contract to paint panoramic views of New Zealand.
They are good people with interests that match our own, wrote Mr. Marsh. But I will warn you that the wife's family keeps slaves, something the new government means to stamp out.
When Dieter read this to Lavinia, she made a face and said, Slaves? Oh dear. The small ship, manned by tattooed Maori sailors, entered the great blue harbor at twilight.
Would it not be best to have a good night's rest and meet with Mr. Oval tomorrow? Asked Dieter, and Lavinia nodded, gazing down at the flashing paddles of men and women in carved canoes all around them.
But Mr. Oval was waiting on the dock, a tall, rumpled fellow with auburn hair and clear blue eyes.
So pleased, so delighted, he murmured,
kissing Lavinia's salt-chapped hand and shaking both of Dieter's.
I thought I would see you settled into Fern House. I have arranged a very simple dinner at my table this evening so we might sketch out a plan, if you are not too exhausted by the journey.
Planning is important, as a month is not nearly enough time to show you the wonders of New Zealand.
They went directly to his house in a garden of trees.
What a majestic view, said Lavinia, admiring the harbor painted umber and violet with sunset dregs.
A Maori servant, one of the slaves, showed them into a sparsely furnished room, the walls melting away in shadow. Candles were the only illumination, which Dieter found very pleasant. He disliked both oil and gas lamps. A small round table was set for three. The servant brought in green-lipped mussels, poured a chilled white hock.
Mr. Oval, delicious. It is reminiscent of German wines, said Dieter, wondering how it was cooled. Did they have ice or snow in this place?
He thought not.
It is a German wine, imported, as all our wine. I doubt this climate could support vineyards, but some think otherwise. I had 20 cases of Bordeaux shipped a decade ago, and it has taken too long a time to recover from the journey. Really, still not drinkable. I'm told reds can take 20 years or more. But the whites have been good, and I've developed rather a preference for them, or so I think.
To our coming journey together, he said, and he raised his glass, smiled at Lavinia. The mussel plates disappeared, replaced by a savory pie of the famous bluff oysters.
Tomorrow you can rest and get settled, and on Thursday I think it would be advantageous for us to sail to the Coromandel Peninsula, where horses will carry us into the forests. Half a century ago horses were unknown here, but they came in with the missionaries, and the Maori took to them. Everyone rides. I understand, Mrs. Breitsprecher, that you especially wish to see the Kauri. Did you bring riding clothes?
He asked Lavinia.
No, said Lavinia. I haven't been on a horse since I was a girl. It didn't occur to me to pack riding clothes.
I think we can arrange a habit for you. My wife, of course, rides bareback, and in a pinch you can always wear men's trousers. Women here on the frontier of civilization are not fashionable. If you are sanguine in temperament, I feel we shall do well.
Lavinia's interest was piqued at the thought of an Englishwoman riding bareback, and tried to imagine what such a woman would be like. An extravagant hoyden, no doubt. And was she herself expected to wear trousers? Was that what their host was suggesting? She kept her jaw clenched against falling agape when Mrs. Oval entered the room. Nashley Oval stood up. Dieter rose, smiling. The woman who came toward them was tall and shapely, beautiful in balance and bone.
She wore a costume of orange cotton skirt fringed with feathers, and on top, a long garment of supple flax that left one shoulder bare. A river of black hair streamed to her waist. Her chin was tattooed with a curious design, and a delicate tattooed line enhanced her shapely lips. Lavinia realized with a shock that she was a Maori.
"Welcome. Welcome to our land," she said in perfect upper-class English, her soft voice dropping at the end of her sentence.
"May I present my wife, a Horangi Oval? Dear heart, these are our guests, Lavinia and Dieter Breitsprecher, with whom we shall travel in your forests beginning on Thursday."
"I am so pleased," said Mrs. Oval,
in a soft, fluid voice that reminded Dieter of a pigeon coat.
"There is so much to show you, and I hope you will come to love this place as we do. We have learned about you both from our common friend Mr. Marsh, whom we met in Italy several years ago."
Great heavens, thought Lavinia, Mr. Marsh again. He plays an invisible role in our lives. A broad path climbed gradually up toward the forests. A Horangi Oval, again in her orange skirt and flax blouse, sat astride a nervous bay mare, dancing and shifting about. Lavinia, feeling constricted and slightly tortured in an ill-fitting riding habit, was on a tractable piebald mare. Dieter, on a rangy gelding, and Mr. Oval on his thoroughbred Queenie, rode behind the two women, talking of Mr. Marsh. Two bareback Maori men, the brothers of Ahorangi, rode in front, turning and calling out comments in good English. The servant and a pack horse laden with full kete baskets followed the party.
"You speak English very well," said Lavinia to Ahorangi. "Yes, thank you. I went to school in London," she said.
At noon, the brothers reined up near a stout tree with a self-important air.
"A cabbage tree," said Ahorangi. "All parts are good to eat. We can thatch roofs, make our rain capes. It gives good medicines. It shows itself as different from other trees, so we plant them sometimes to mark a notable place. Let us have lunch here with the tea kouka."
The path rose, and they entered a totara grove, the elegant trees rising high, showing needled spikes and red berries.
"This," said Ahorangi, gesturing with her expressive hands, "is the tree we esteem above all others."
"Even above the kauri?" asked Lavinia.
"Yes, the kauri is important, and we revere it, but it is white men who love it to the exclusion of other trees. For them, it is the ideal timber tree. But it is the totara with whom our lives and religion are even more deeply entwined. Like kauri, it is one of the great chieftain trees, also rimu, kahikatea, and rata. Those are our royal trees."
"They remind me somewhat of yews," said Dieter, looking at the totara, "though they are much taller, very tall indeed."
"Oh yes," said Mr. Oval. "They are a much favored tree, both by the Maori and whites. The Maori prefer totara for carvings and war canoes, houses and so much else, framing timbers even. The fruit is tasty and plentiful. A bark decoction controls fever. White men like it for its rot-resistant timber."
Ahorangi led Lavinia to a flounced rimu with drooping fronds.
"This is my favorite," she said. "I love the rimu. But so do the timbermen."
She touched a dangle of green.
"The botanists say it is a pine, but it is different. It has no cones like European pines, but a good kind of berry. Kakapo, hear them? Like the berries very much."
In fact, all the previous night in the fern house, Lavinia had heard a smothered thumping sound like someone dropping cannonballs from the trees. Now she heard it again. Ahorangi told her it was the mating call of the kakapo, a fat, puffy parrot that could not fly but spent its time in the rimu gorging on fruit.
"Usually, they make this sound only at night, but I think this one may be rather ardent."
Ahorangi touched Lavinia's arm and with a sad half-smile said,
"I must ask you something. I am afraid for the rimu. My husband says you are an important lady who owns a timber company, and that you come here to look at the trees with a thought to cut them. I hope you will love our trees and not cut them. They are our lives. To live happily in this place, we need the trees. I am afraid for them. You will not cut them, please."
Lavinia said nothing, and in a few minutes Ahorangi understood the silence and walked back to her husband and brothers. For the rest of the day, she stayed with them and made no effort to speak again with Lavinia. Dieter rode up. "What is it?" he said, aware something was not right.
"She does not want us to cut any trees," said Lavinia.
"She begged me not to cut them. I did not know what to say. There are so many trees here that there is no possibility they could be all removed as she seems to fear."
"Let us hope so," said Dieter. "That is my wish." And he too fell silent.
They passed through the Rimu and followed a twisting trail that wound around a slope and into a grove. Lavinia and Dieter knew at once these were the Kauri. They could be nothing else. Massively broad gray trunks with branches bunched at the top like the victims of a robbery throwing up their hands. But the staggering size of these monsters stunned them both.
"My God," said Dieter. "This is the enchanted forest from some ancient tale."
He dismounted, tied his horse to a shrub, and began to walk around a very, very large Kauri. He was suddenly joyful.
"They are too big to be cut," he said to Lavinia. "They cannot be brought down."
"They can," Lavinia thought. "They will be." Yet she, too, had been a little moved by the great silent trees, so immense, so helpless. After dinner, Lavinia tried to make amends.
"Dear Mrs. Oval," she said, "please, call me Ahorangi.
And you must call me Lavinia. I want to say that if I am here to look at the Kauri trees for cutting, my husband is here because he believes in replanting what one takes. We wonder if it is possible to plant infant Kauri trees, perhaps one for each large one that is cut, to care for the young trees as they grow and age." Ahorangi gave a small laugh.
"The big Kauri trees are very old, thousands of years. We will take you to see Kaurauru of Tutamoe. It is the largest one. It would certainly be 100 human generations before a seedling could replace one fallen mature Kauri of such girth."
"One must have faith in the power of a seed," said Dieter. "We plant them, knowing we will never see them when they are grown. We plant them for the health of the world, rather than for people not yet born." Nashley Oval leaned forward in his chair, his face tense and excited.
This idea of planting Kauris, I like this very much. I wish to make a nursery, I suppose it would be a nursery, for starting young trees. I am not quite sure how they propagate." He looked at his wife.
"They have cones, and the cones carry the seeds. Many times you have seen the winged seeds spiraling down to the ground, riding on the wind, no?"
"Yes. So all one would have to do is gather those seeds and put them in a bed of soil?"
Dieter spoke up. "Likely one would get better results by gathering cones not quite ripe enough to disperse their seeds, and these should come from younger trees in vigorous good health. I know nothing of the germination rate of Kauri seeds, but there are bound to be variations. When do the winged seeds begin to disperse?"
"I would say February, March," said Ahorangi. "In the autumn, a few months hence."
"I should never get used to the seasons being opposite," said Lavinia.
"Oh, it's not difficult," said Nashley Oval. "It all falls into place quite naturally."
He was quiet while the guests murmured over the roasted hoki fish with shallot sauce.
"I plan to empty my glass house of lettuces and green peas and collect Kauri seeds this coming February. I shall try my hand at starting young Kauri trees."
"You will be the first in the world, dear Nashley," said Ahorangi, touching his hand.
Dieter spoke earnestly. "Mr. Oval, if you do such a thing, allow me to congratulate you on a valuable hobby horse. You will find yourself lavishing your infant seedlings with affection and tender regard for their welfare. But pray, do not give up your vegetables. If you can, do construct a glasshouse especially for the cowrie. I would be most happy to contribute to such a venture in the interest of improving the future.
Ahorangi spoke to Lavinia. You have not yet seen the young cowries. They call them rikas, and they look rather different than the mature trees. Tall and thin, like young girls before they develop. They are a bit amusing. We shall see all ages while you are here.
2 weeks passed with excursions to the kauri groves. Lavinia bought a large shoreline grove mixed with rimu and told Ahorangi and Nashley Oval that Duke and Breitsprecher would send men to begin cutting and milling these trees. It would take time to hire the right men, assemble the mill machinery, and ship all to Auckland. No kauri in that grove would fall for a few more years. The woman sighed but nodded when Lavinia told her that Duke and Breitsprecher would pay Mr. Oval to set up a kauri nursery and maintain it, to plant young seedlings when the cut was finished. Although Axel Cowes had known and worked with Lavinia for years, he chose to send his cable with news of the Chicago fire to Dieter, who came into the bedroom where Lavinia sat writing in her notebook of expenses.
My dear, we have had a cable from Axel Cowes. He says a great fire has burned half the city, even in the business district. People are ruined and homeless. There is much suffering.
Lavinia read the cable for herself.
We have lost warehouses, but on the other hand, Axel says orders for milled lumber are pouring in. The ashes are not yet cold, but rebuilding has begun. That is the famous Chicago spirit, she said. But he does not detail our losses.
I dare say it will take some weeks to understand the situation fully.
He says Mr. Flentz is away on business. He is not sure where, and so there is no comment from him. I very much wish there were. Mr. Flentz could give some figures.
One thing is clear, Dieter. We must go back as soon as we may, said Lavinia. We are needed in Chicago, though I dread the return voyage. They left before the kauri cones were ripe, but Nashley Oval promised to send a bushel to Dieter, who was determined to learn the peculiarities of the plant.
We will write, said Dieter.
Lavinia's mind was already in Chicago, responding to the city's desperate need of lumber. If the trip from San Francisco to Sydney had been rough, the return was worse. Ginger tea did not help Lavinia, who spent most of her time lying green and thin in her berth. Dieter urged her to come up on deck and get some fresh air, and she tottered up and almost immediately retched and then fainted. The worst seemed to be over by mid-voyage, although she took very little except bread and tea.
I will be better when we are on solid ground, she moaned. Oh, speed the day!
Back at their renovated house, the air still carried the stench of charred timbers from the city when the wind was right. Lavinia improved only slightly. Nauseated and dizzy, she could not appreciate the new wing with its opulent suite, and, in place of a cupola, a large balcony with a broad view of Lake Michigan. Dieter crowed over his glass house and potting shed, and was pleased to wear crusty boots and a long canvas apron all day long, dressing only for dinner. Lavinia could no longer bear breakfast.
Really, this can't continue. I am worried about you, said Dieter. I have asked Dr. Honey to call and examine you this afternoon, get his opinion of your health.
All is so beautiful here now, I wish to enjoy it with you. I want us to walk together in the forest again, to admire the moon on the water. I want you well again.
But Lavinia knew what Dr. Honey would say. She had not expected it, but she knew. She waited until the doctor made his diagnosis, and then at the dinner table, eating only shreds of poached chicken breast, she told Dieter.
I am going to have a child. This nausea will pass. I will be in health again, but I will be a mother, and you a father.
Dieter laid down his fork and looked at her. He nodded, but said nothing. After a long silence, he looked at her, smiled, and said, "Hurrah!" loudly. The maid rushed in from the kitchen, saw them smiling at each other. Back in the kitchen, she said to the cook, "Mr. Dieter is glad to be home again." "I shall have to discover a first-rate nursemaid," said Lavinia. Lavinia went to the office the next day feeling quite well and even pleased. She would know the mystery of motherhood. They would be parents. She felt she was, at last, a complete adult. "Good morning, Anig," she said. "I'll look through the post for an hour. Come in at 9 to take letters." The letters took all morning. One was rather annoying. A subcontractor logger wrote a rude note demanding the survey map of the Sticker River camps. "This fellow sets out his demand as though he owns the property," said Lavinia.
"Oh, I'll deal with that, Miss Lavinia," said Anig. "It never should have been put in with your post. Mr. Flintz knows all about it."
Lavinia expected the birth would be a frightful ordeal as she was not young and it was her first child, but she might have already produced half a dozen for all the difficulty. It was a quick and easy labor. The boy was healthy and in perfect form. Lavinia and Dieter had talked endlessly about names. Lavinia first suggested James Duke Breitsprecher, but Dieter made a face. Next, she suggested Charles Duke Breitsprecher, incorporating the name of the ancestor. Dieter asked why not use his father's name, Bardewulf. But Lavinia repeated, "Bardewulf Duke Breitsprecher? What a mouthful for the poor mite." And in the end, Charles Duke prevailed. Dieter asked himself why humans reached into the ancestral pot for infant names, but found no answer. She quickly regained her full health and went back to the office when Charles was 10 days old, but not before she met with the elderly lawyer she and Dieter used for personal legal affairs and named Charles Duke Breitsprecher heir of her estate and business holdings. Now, all was well. The future of the baby and the company was secure. Her greater interest was not in the infant, but in rotary lathes. Duke and Breitsprecher was entering the plywood market. Here was a use for birch, long despised as a weed tree. Her engineers were experimenting with various glued-up wood layers from different species. And they were discussing an interesting new wood, balsa wood from Ecuador, very light and very strong. She listened to their reports of its remarkable weight-strength ratio. The problem was that balsa trees did not constitute whole forests, but grew in scattered places throughout the dripping tropical forests. Finding the trees and getting the logs out was the difficulty. She thought it was not worth the effort, and balsa logging went on the shelf. The day Lavinia went back to the office, Dieter took the baby from his nurse and carried him into the park, laid him down under the newly leafed silver maple, propped himself on his elbow beside the child. Charles stared up into the quivering green where dots of sunlight winked. But, wondered Dieter, how much could he see? Were the shapes of leaves sharp, or was all a green massed blur? He picked the baby up and looked into his small, pointed face, seeing his expression change to one of interest as his eyes focused on Dieter's mustache. The baby's arms flew up in a nervous start. "You see, Charles, it is a tree. Your life and fate are bound to trees. You will become the man of the forests who will stand by my side." One morning, Axel Cowes walked through the forest to the Breitsprecher kitchen door at 6 in the morning.
"Good morning, Mrs. Balklop. Is Lavinia up?"
"Awake, I'm sure, but likely not up and dressed. I have orders to send her coffee pot up at 6:30 sharp." Lavinia had abandoned tea for cups of strong black coffee sweetened with honey.
"If you can add another cup, I will take it up to her myself. There is most urgent business. A crisis I must discuss with her immediately."
At that moment, Dieter came into the kitchen for his coffee mug. He would take it out to the potting shed and begin the morning's work.
"Axel, what brings you here at this early hour? A tree down in the forest?"
"In a manner of speaking, I came to break the news to Lavinia and to you that Mr. Flintz has done a bunk,"
Mrs. Ballclop tipped her head to hear everything. What does that mean? Done a bunk?
It means that he has left the city and the country for parts unknown, perhaps Texas, as they say of all absconders, with a great chunk of Duke and Breitsprecher funds in his pockets.
There was a ringing silence. Cowes drew in his breath, said,
And Annick Duncan, too. She went with him.
Oh, 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 said Dieter. Let us go up to Lavinia. She will take this hard.
Part 9. The Shadow in the Cup. 1844 to the 1960s. 60. Prodigal Sons. The years had been hard on Aaron Sell, Jeannot's only surviving son. When Jeannot left for New Zealand with Mr. Bone, Aaron found his way to Mi'kma'ki and the family band of Kuntaw, his father's grandfather, who had, after the death of his wife Beatrix, left the Penobscot Bay house and returned to Nova Scotia, hoping to live the old Mi'kmaq way. Aaron made an impression on Etienne, Kuntaw's grown son of 26 winters, as a brash youth with nothing of Jeannot's reputation for merriness. Aaron had expected some kind of ceremonial welcome, the warmth of acceptance, had hoped for dissolving mysteries of who he was. He had expected young women. Now that he was here, he did not know what he should do. He had no understanding of eel weirs, could not tell a blueberry from an enchantment. He could not hunt caribou or beaver. In any case, there were no beaver or caribou.
I have no friends here. Everyone is against me, he said to Etienne in his most piteous voice.
You have to learn. Come with me to the river, and I show you how we repair the weir.
But Aaron could not fit rocks together, could not hammer stakes in the right position.
I need a gun, he said,
but there were no guns for anyone without money.
You want too much,
said old Kuntaw, the Sell clan's elder and sagmaw.
Here you must learn to give, not take.
But after two restless years in Mi'kma'ki, Aaron went back to Boston, looked for Jeannot, who was still in New Zealand, and drifted around the waterfront. It was on the waterfront that two jovial men got into conversation with him, invited him to the alehouse, and bought him drink. Later, he had a misted memory of walking between his two new friends toward the docked ships, but no recollection at all of how he came to be aboard the Elsie Jones. He woke the next morning to the painful strike of the bosun's rope end.
Get up, you stinking Indian beggar brat!
He was a green hand on the Elsie Jones, bound to London with a cargo of spars and masts.
You cannot do this! I know my rights! You cannot keep me against my will!
What? Are you a sea lawyer? One of them always prating about rights and free speech and such? I'll learn you what your rights are. You'll toe the mark, and the mark will be high.
The bosun, James Crumble, instantly took a strong dislike to this young half-breed who spoke of rights, put him in the hands of the crew for daily greenhorn instruction in the names and functions of the ropes, the tackle, the watches, the names and functions of the bewildering kinds of sails, the workings of the tackle fall, the daily duties beginning with the swabbing of the deck before the sun was up. They gave him tasks spangled with mortal dangers, sent him clambering up the futtock shrouds in great wind and icy rain, snarled confusing orders salted with vile epithets such as toad-sucking jib-cat and scabby jackeen, picked away relentlessly in faulting his lubberly errors. Nor did Crumble spare the rope's end, cracking it every time Aaron opened his mouth.
Shut your gob, you hopeless fucking hen turd of a fool, or I'll spread your guts on the deck! Crack!
The trip was wretched. Storm after storm, and in the intervals between, rough seas. A set of monster waves cleaned the deck of the spars stored there, and lightning struck their mainmast. Putting up a new mast in the heaving ship cost two men their lives, and Aaron expected he would be the dreaded third man. He lay in his hammock, trying to think how it would feel when he was pitched into the lurching brine, how long the drowning would take. He asked the old hands, who agreed there was sure to be a third death before they docked, and heard the comforting news that it would be over very quickly. Just one or two water-choked gasps from the shock of the cold water, and then you don't feel nothing. During the voyage, Aaron grew in strength, knowledge, and hatred for Crumble. He swore to himself that if he survived, he would kill the man once they were ashore. But the bosun melted away as soon as his boots hit the London docks. It took weeks, weeks of asking and walking warily along the great wharves in the odorous London fog before he found a ship, though he cared not whether bound for Canada or Boston. Day after day, the acid fog was so dense that men 5 feet away were wraiths. In those weeks, he began to feel he had somehow changed, and in no minor way. Physically, he felt well, strong and alert. He was 19, had become more watchful, more inclined to read the body movements and faces of people around him. He wanted to go back to Kuntaw's Mi'kmaw band. "Likely old Kuntaw is dead by now," he said aloud. Maybe Etienne was in his place, one of the other men. He would try again with a more willing heart. His presumption of himself as the central figure in any scene had been scuttled by the bosun James Crumble. In a grog shop one afternoon, he heard two sailors talking coarsely about what they would do in Halifax. He moved closer, listened, said, "Halifax bound? Ship looking for crew?" They gazed at him, at his calloused hands, tarry canvas pants.
"Excel sails tomorrow morning. Go talk to the bosun. He keeps aboard all night. Connie Binney."
Binney was a red-bearded, good-natured fellow from Maine, for Maine men were as common as hempen ropes on the wharves of the world.
"Well, yes, sailing for Halifax, carrying China trade goods, first for Halifax, a load of China dishes and some porcelain dogs. At least they call 'em dogs, but look more like pollywogs to me. Cobblestone ballast. You ain't green, are ye? Not a landsman? Sailed afore the mast, have ye?"
Aaron said he wasn't so very green as he'd sailed on the Elsie Jones. Binney raised his eyebrows.
"And so you attended Miss Crumble's academy for poor sailor lads?"
"I did, sir, and enjoyed a rigorous education, and survived."
Binney laughed. Aaron was hired as an able seaman. After Crumble, Connie Binney seemed too easy, giving orders in a pleasant voice. It seemed unnatural. The ship traveled against brisk westerlies, beating to windward all the way, and Aaron's spirits lifted with the exhilaration of sailing home, no matter what waited at the far end. Going directly to Halifax would save him the torturous overland journey from Boston. He could walk to Pitupok, the Mi'kmaw settlement on the shore of the saltwater inland lake, in 2 or 3 days. He thought he could find Mi'kmaq there who could take him to Iktagumkuk. And the niggling question he had been pushing down kept kicking its way back into his thought. Why was he going back to the Mi'kmaw life? He had a calling now. He could make a sailor's living. He could go back to the sea if he had to, as long as it wasn't a whaling. Long before land came in sight, they could smell it. A mix of softwood smoke and drying cod blended with the familiar salt of the North Atlantic. A rushing flood of joy made Aaron grin foolishly at nothing. He got his pay, shook hands with Binney, who said,
"If you want a berth on the XL again, we'll be back here come April or May. Another voyage to China."
Aaron hurried through the knotted streets of Halifax, his mind filling with imagined conversations as he tried to explain why he had returned. Etienne had been angry when he left. Yet in his new sense of self, he was glad to be back. He was ready to trap and construct weirs, to fish. He no longer expected his relatives to honor him simply because he had come to them, because he was Jeannot's son. His sea skills might somehow find a use. He'd see what he'd see. The trail through the forest he remembered was now mostly cleared land with settlements and a few farms, the too familiar sight of settlers burning swathes of woodland. He met two white men children driving cattle along the shore. As they passed, they began screaming,
"Dirty Indian bug eater!"
and threw clamshells at him. The ragged trail now showed trees again, sprouts growing up from stumps. This was the way he had taken 5 years earlier after his father left with Mr. Bone. A Mi'kmaq family had fed him and given him a place to sleep, had told him cells had all gone to Iktagamkuk, and that if he wanted them, he should go to Sydney, the easternmost port, and send word over the water. Someone would come. He remembered the man's name as Joe Funnel. Just another mile, he thought, and he would see that wigwam near the trail. He walked farther than a mile and knew he had somehow missed it, turned back, looking hard into the scrappy woods. Some distance in, he saw a few poles. That was the right place. He went toward them. Yes, it had been a wigwam once, but was now weathered poles with rotted skins and bark at the base. They must have moved to the Mi'kmaq village a few miles farther on. He picked up his pace. He was frightened by the village. Shabby wigwams sat on rough ground amid slash and baked patches of bare earth. He saw smoke issuing from only one wigwam. There were no dogs, no people in sight. He walked slowly toward the wigwam making the smoke, but as he passed a derelict jumble of poles with only saplings instead of bark for a covering, he heard someone cough, a retching, choking cough that sounded like it was tearing out someone's lungs. He bent to the opening. Hello? Anybody there? Stupid question. Of course there was someone there. Someone dying of violent spasms of coughing. He peered into the gloom and saw a bundle of rags jerk forward and cough and cough and cough. The more he looked, the more he saw. There were others in there. Emaciated skeletal arms rose as if to ward him off. Huge, feverish eyes fixed him. An infant lay naked and dreadfully still on the ground. He went to the next wigwam, where a comatose man lay on the earth, only the very faint rise and fall of his ribcage showing he lived. He did not speak. Farther along in the sole wigwam issuing smoke sat a man and woman, both very thin, but able to move and talk. The man said their names, Lewis and Sarah Paul. What has happened? Asked Aaron, wondering what was wrong with himself. He was choking, hardly able to speak. He told them he wanted to find the way to Iktagamkuk, where others of his family lived. But here in this ruined village, what had happened here? What had overcome these people? Where were Joe Funnel and his wife, who had been so kind to him years earlier? Whatever had occurred also might have befallen the Cell clan in Iktagamkuk.
They die. Everybody sick. No food. Die, die, die. Children all die. Mi'kmaq people now walk around, look for food, eat dirt. No firewood. White men shoot, say it their firewood. We make potato garden, but too many rain. Potato all go rot. We come any place, try make wigwam. Always white men come and set fire. Come with clubs and sticks. They drive us on. Nowhere to go. Sometime good white men give food, coats. Only look for more good white men. Mi'kmaq people walk looking. Keep walking. Now lie down and die.
Aaron knew that since the death of Amboise, his childhood brother, he had had a cold heart. But now, appalled, he felt it burning. He had no food, but he had his wages. He reached for his money. His impulse was to thrust it into their hands, but he considered. They were too weak, he thought, to go buy food. But where was the nearest place? It would take him 2 days to go to and return from Halifax. Sydney was closer, and perhaps he would pass a white man farmer who would sell him food.
I will come back with food, he said, and rushed forward on the trail.
2 miles along, he saw a settler's house with a large garden, a cow, and chickens. Before he could enter the gate, a tall white man with glassy eyes and sprays of hair like black grass on the sides of his head came rushing around the corner of the house.
Get off of my property, he shouted. Get, damn Indian!
He walked on toward Sydney, passing settlers' houses and gardens. He tried once more to buy food, and an angry man shot at him. Once more he tried. He walked around the corner of a small church to the pastor's house,
and saw the housewife on her knees weeding onions. Poised to run, he said, "Ma'am, I would like to buy some of your vegetables for some poor starving Indians down the trail."
"Why, them poor things," she said. "Let me ask the pastor."
And she went into the house. When she came out again, the pastor was with her, his yellowish old face drawn into a stern expression.
"So, who is starving? Indians, eh? You don't know how often I hear this complaint, but we do live in a time when the red man passes from the scene, replaced by the vigorous European settler. The Indian has to learn to work and earn his living, grow a garden, and put the harvest by against winter. Charity does but delay the inevitable."
Then, taking in Aaron's posture and face, which suddenly looked less like that of a soft-hearted white man and more like the visage of a murderous Indian with a barely suppressed intent to kill, he stepped back a little.
"Course we do try to help, even knowing it. Yes, course we'll sell you some vegetables. What will you, taters? Maggie, pull some taters and carrots for the poor Indians."
Hastily, the two pulled at stems, plucked young turnips from the ground, heaped the plunder on the ground for Aaron to pick up as best he could. He stuffed everything inside his shirt, the warm turnips scratching his skin. He stood up with the last potato in his hand and said,
"This potato means life to those people."
He held out his money. The pastor snatched it and, with the passage of tender, recovered from his fright and said,
"I would say that the will of God, rather than a potato, decides the matter."
Aaron did not wait for the end of the sentence, but was on his way back to the broken wigwams. On the trail, he saw movement under an elderberry shrub. He picked up a heavy maple stick from the slash pile alongside the trail. He came closer and saw the animal was one of the white man's favored creatures, a house cat. It had something, a bird, and he saw a wing rise and fall as the cat crunched the wing joint. Closer and closer, gripping the maple stick, came Aaron. The cat, intent on savaging the young partridge, which was large enough and still lively enough to escape, did not abandon the prey, and Aaron crushed its head with the first blow. He then wrung the still struggling young partridge's neck.
"This is the will of your white man, God,"
he murmured to the cat, taking it up by the hind legs, and, with the limp partridge inside his bulging shirt, walked on toward the wigwams of Lewis and Sarah Paul, left Lewis making a fire, and Sarah skinning the cat. The next day in Sydney, he saw five Mi'kmaq women sitting together on the dock. They seemed easy and content, joking with one another. They looked healthy. One of the women, he was almost sure it was Losa, the wife of Peter Sell, one of Kunta's sons, the older brother of Etienne. Round-faced, with very red lips, Losa carried a single basket, and the others, their handiwork sold, were chiding her for making something so clumsy no one wanted to buy it. She said something he could not hear. They laughed, and it felt good to him to hear Mi'kmaq women laugh. And there was Peter Sell's fishing smack at the far end of the wharf. The basket makers began to board the vessel, chattering and laughing, still showing each other bits of finery or foods they had bought at the stores. Aaron, heavy in thought and mentally rehearsing a variety of pleas to Kunta and Etienne to come west to the ruined wigwams and save the starving people and bring them back to Igdagamkuk, followed. As they left Sydney Harbor and entered the gray ocean, Aaron went into the bow and faced east, taking bouquets of spray in the face, staring into the haze of distance. Why had he come back? What had